So please join me in welcoming our next speaker, Timothy Ingold from the University of Aberdeen. And he's going to be giving us a talk called The Social Brain.
Thanks very much. I was actually asked by the organizers to, or instructed by the organizers to give a talk on the social brain. It's not a title that I chose myself, and it's a challenge for me because whenever I hear the phrase social brain, the first thing that comes to mind is what is widely known among evolutionary psychologists as the social brain hypothesis. And this is a hypothesis to which I am resolutely opposed. I think it's dreadful. On the one hand, it reduces the social to the operative, and on the other hand, it elevates the brain to the executive, making social life look like the aggregate effect of brains telling their owners what to do. The challenge for me then is to ascertain whether an alternative understanding might be possible, both of the social and of the brain, according to which the notion of the social brain could actually make some sense. So in this spirit, I'm not sure if it works, but I'll attempt to show that the brain is social because life is. Brain tissue grows in the matrix of the social, much, I think, as vegetation grows in the matrix of the earth. And in this sense, everything that lives is social. The brain, as envisaged by advocates of the social brain hypothesis, by contrast, is itself a purely hypothetical entity. It can neither live nor grow. So first of all, what is this hypothesis, this so-called social brain hypothesis? It all goes back to an influential paper published in 1976 by the psychologist and student of animal behavior, Nick Humphrey. In this paper, Humphrey argued that the principal selective pressures behind the evolution of the so-called higher intellectual faculties of humans and other primates lay not in the technical dealings of these animals with objects in their physical environments, but in their social dealings with one another in the context of life in close-knit communities of conspecifics. Dubbed at the time the Machiavellian intelligence hypothesis, Humphrey's idea inspired a good deal of work on the complex dynamics of relationships in social groups of monkeys and apes. Introducing a collection of papers on the subject published in 1988, Andy Whiten and Dick Byrne triumphantly declared that the idea of social intelligence is one whose time has come, although it's actually had many antecedents. And clearly this work was intended to convey a message about the evolution of those cognitive and intellectual faculties that are supposed to be unique to humans. Well, to a social anthropologist like myself, what was most striking about it, it seemed to me, was that the model of human sociality invoked to set the pattern of non-human primate life seemed to owe more to the researchers' own dealings with colleagues in academic conferences and senior common rooms than to the experience of everyday life in small and intimate groups. So a Cambridge common room is a somewhat Machiavellian environment, but whether you can extend the Cambridge common room to hunter-gatherers or chimpanzees is another matter. Humphrey even described the Society of Primates as a collegiate community, and he was, of course, from Cambridge. According to the traditional account of the evolution of human intelligence, which goes back to Darwin and Wallace, the pressures that favoured intellectual advance lay in man's, and it was specifically man's and not woman's, interactions with components of the physical environment, such as predators and prey. The use and manufacture of tools played a central role in this argument. Men who were more sagacious, as Darwin liked to say, with bigger and better brains, could design more ingenious tools, thereby securing a reproductive advantage. So intelligence-enhancing variations would tend to be preserved in future generations, leading to yet further advances in the technical sphere, and so on, through mutual reinforcement. This view of the evolution of intelligence continued to enjoy considerable support. For example, Sue Parker and Kathleen Gibson, in a 1979 paper in Behavior and Brain Sciences, argued that feeding strategies and, above all, extractive foraging with tools were the primary determinants of the kind of intelligence possessed by the earliest hominids, and that its further development was an adaptive response to complex hunting involving things like aimed missile throwing, stone tool manufacture, animal butchery, food division, and the construction of shelters. Now, following Humphrey's lead, critics of this kind of traditional view argued that the intellectual capacities demonstrated by non-human primates in laboratory settings, where they were tested on various tasks involving the manipulation of gadgets of different kinds, are far in excess of anything they might need for dealing with their physical environments under natural conditions. Since natural selection does not generally perfect an attribute beyond the level that's necessary to ensure that an animal gets by in its normal circumstances, some other factor must be adduced to account for the apparently excess capacity. And that factor, was argued, is complex sociality. Given the relatively long period of dependency of the young, which is conducive to the transmission of behaviour by learning, and the consequent overlap of generations in the social group, the potential for intra-group conflict is as great as the need to maintain community solidarity. The management of relationships with other individuals in the group therefore calls for considerable skill, because at every moment the animal has to anticipate not only the immediate effects of its own actions, but also the ways that these actions might be perceived by others, and how their outcomes then may be qualified by actions initiated by these others on the basis of their own perceptions. It's a very complicated chess game going on. If the intellectual capacities of non-human primates were enhanced through selection for social skills, then, so the argument goes, the same must have been true in the evolution of our own species. For the technical problems that confronted our ancestors in their procurement of subsistence were not particularly difficult. Most would already have been solved and had only to be learned by each generation from its predecessors. But it's precisely the importance of learning, which takes the weight off technical problems of adaptation, that sets such a heavy load on social ones. Now, in a 1998 paper entitled The Social Brain Hypothesis, psychologist Robin Dunbar returned to the issue of why it is that humans have such big brains. He explains that the traditional consensus was that brains evolved to process information of ecological relevance. But why should humans need brains of extraordinary size and complexity, and which are hugely expensive in terms of the amount of energy needed to keep them going, in order to achieve what other animals can manage perfectly well with much smaller ones? Dunbar's proposal is that large brains reflect the computational demands of complex social systems. In effect, what had been called the Machiavellian intelligence hypothesis was now renamed the social brain hypothesis. It's basically the same thing. What other possible explanations are there, Dunbar asks, to account for primate brain evolution? Well, one possibility is that it is epiphenomenal, simply a byproduct of increased body size. So body size increases, brain size increases too, in proportion. Another possibility is that it's developmental, that it has to do, for example, with the maternal metabolic input in early brain development. It's an idea that goes back to Engels, who thought that we had big brains because we ate lots of meat. But given the energy costs of large brains, Dunbar argues, you'd think that natural selection would favour curbs on excessive brain growth unless it conferred an actual positive advantage. And yet the very opposite seems to have happened. And this leads Dunbar to the final pair of possible explanations, namely the ecological and the social. An example of an ecological explanation might be that if you live by foraging, you need a large brain to help you remember where the food is. Or again, if you forage over a large range, you need a large brain to house an extensive mental map. Or again, if you're extracting food from a matrix, such as tubers from the earth or nuts from shells, you need a large brain to help you figure out how to do it. Yet, non-human foragers, with their comparatively small brains, seem to be able to manage all these things perfectly well. They know where to go to find food, they don't get lost, and they're quite clever at extracting resources from all sorts of difficult spots. So by a process of elimination, this leaves us with the social explanation as the only possibility left. And as I've shown, Dunbar was certainly not the first to argue that the demands of living with conspecifics placed a positive selective pressure on the evolution of intelligence. The one thing that was innovative in his argument lay in his suggestion that these social demands could be correlated with the size of the group. Specifically, the larger the group, the greater the number of relationships that an individual would have simultaneously to manage, and the more information about these relationships the individual has to be able to process and manipulate. There is thus, Dunbar argues, an information processing bottleneck which limits the size of the social group to what the brains of its individual members can handle. As brain size is increased, so the neck of the bottle gradually enlarged, and with it, the sizes of groups in which individuals were able to live. And it seems, according to his calculations and a certain manipulation of the evidence, that in all modern humans, it has reached the magic number of 150. But over the last decade, Dunbar has been vigorously promulgating his social brain hypothesis with some considerable success. It has all the ingredients of a good scientific story. It's also, in my view, complete nonsense. The hypothesis is misconceived in at least three respects. First of all, it rests on a false opposition between social and ecological relations. Secondly, it assumes that the workings of the mind can be equated with the operation of neural machinery internal to the organism. And thirdly, in treating the brain as a computational organ, it divides the brain from the body that allegedly responds to its commands. This is effectively neuro-Cartesianism. So let me start with the opposition between the social and the ecological. The question is, how do we stake out the domain of social relations? And on what grounds can we distinguish, if indeed at all, relations that are social from relations that are not? Now, for most social anthropologists, at least until quite recently, it's kind of gone without saying that social relations are human relations. Indeed, this equation is presupposed in the very constitution of our discipline, because only if social relations are human relations can the study of social relations be an aspect of the study of humanity. And that's what we social anthropologists claim to do. The mark of the social, it's commonly thought, lies in personal qualities of agency and intentionality, feeling, memory, and speech that are brought to bear in the formation of relationships and that are intrinsic to the kinds of beings we call human. We say that a being is human, we reckon that it's got those kinds of qualities. If an animal possessed these qualities, well, then we'd be tempted to call it human too, even though it might not be regarded as an individual of the human species. People in Western societies, for example, often say this of their pets, particularly dogs. The pet dog is taken to be a character with intentions and feelings of its own, who knows its human companions well and responds intelligently to the sounds of their voices. So we say, well, it's a dog. I know it's a dog, but it's a human as far as I'm concerned. Yet companion animals might be taken as the exception that proves the rule, because it seems that we can enter into social relations with non-human animals only to the extent that through close association, something of our humanity has, so to speak, rubbed off on them, transforming them almost into honorary humans. Indeed, cynics might argue that in treating pets as persons, we're indulging in an elaborate anthropomorphic pretense. From there, however, it's but a short step to the conclusion that social relations are human relations because they're with individuals who belong, whether in reality or the imagination, to the same species as we do. To take this step is, in effect, to convert what was a purely contingent aspect of social relations, that is, the species membership of participants, into their defining feature. But once we've taken this step, it's a step which lies in the slippage from the existential condition of being human, with all the stuff about intentionality, memory, and so on, to the taxonomic attribution of human being, Homo sapiens. Once we take that step, the path is clear to extend the concept of the social to cover the interactions that any kind of creature, human or non-human, has with its conspecifics. For me, taking this line, social relations are human relations because I happen to be a human being. If I were an ant, then my social relations would be with other ants, not with humans. Humans would simply be part of the physical environment, whereas my social relations are with other ants. Just as a human, I say my social relations are with other humans. Ants, they're just part of the physical environment. Now, it's in just this derivative sense, connoting relations among conspecifics, that the notion of society was taken up in the writings of sociobiologists and other students of animal behavior. It goes back to E.O. Wilson's famous text on sociobiology, where he defines society as a group of individuals belonging to the same species and organized in a cooperative manner. Nothing there about intentions or memory or feeling or anything like that. Following Wilson's leads, sociobiologists have made it their business to describe and explain the varieties of social behavior across every branch of the animal kingdom. And they insist that human sociality, for all its distinctiveness and complexity, is just one variant of a widespread phenomenon whose study should represent a particular specialty within a much broader, more inclusive science. And that science, of course, for them is evolutionary biology. But whatever successes evolutionary biologists might have had in accounting for patterns of cooperative or altruistic behavior in terms of its consequences for reproductive fitness, their explanations take us nowhere in understanding those qualities of intentionality, sentience, memory, and speech that seem to us to be so central to the experience of social being. Indeed, sociobiological explanations carry force only to the extent that these qualities can be relegated to the status of epiphenomenal byproducts of more fundamental behavior-generating programs. It's rather ironic, actually, to reflect that the identification of society with the domain of intraspecific interactions, which underwrites the sociobiological enterprise, came about only thanks to an original assumption, which sociobiologists categorically reject, that society is the unique preserve of humankind. Because we originally think, oh, it's just humans who are social, and then say, okay, society is a product of interactions among members of the human species, therefore society is interactions among conspecifics, therefore we've got something social whenever you see interactions among conspecifics, whether humans or ants. And the thing turns it over in a kind of somersault. Now, of course, sociobiologists are not the only people to have claimed that non-human animals can enjoy a social life. The understanding is widely reported, for example, in the ethnography, with which I happen to be familiar, of northern native hunters around the circumpolar region in northern North America, and northern Europe and Siberia. The understanding that animals form communities of their own, much like human ones. But for these hunting peoples, the sociality of animals owes nothing to the fact that they are of the same species. Animals are social not because they cooperate with others of their own kind, but because they are thought to reveal in their actions the same qualities of intentionality, feeling, memory, and indeed speech that humans do. This is what makes it possible for humans to have relationships with them. So one doesn't have to regard animals, as people in Western societies sometimes regard their pets, as pseudo-humans in order to have such relationships. But if social relations so readily override the boundaries of species, as these hunters maintain, then the sociobiological restriction of sociality to relations among conspecifics makes no sense at all. For them, interpersonality, person to person, not intraspecificity, individual to individual within a species, is the mark of the social. And what species the person belongs to is, to some extent, superficial. Well, by and large, Western analysts have taken a pretty dim view of the claims of hunters or of indigenous peoples more generally to relate on a person-to-person basis with non-human animals. Nick Humphrey, for example, to go back to his original paper, argues that when people apply an intelligence fashioned by natural selection for dealing with social partners to other kinds of entities in the environment, they are bound to make mistakes. Such applications are examples of what he calls the fallacious reasoning in which primitive and not so primitive people indulge. In doing so, says Humphrey, they are explicitly adopting a social model, expecting nature to participate in the transaction, but nature will not transact with men. She goes her own way regardless. Now, in anthropology, this allegedly fallacious reasoning to which primitive people are susceptible has traditionally gone by the name of magic. And in his classic work on the Trobriand Islanders, entitled Coral Gardens and Their Magic, one of the great anthropological classics, comes from 1935, Bronislaw Malinowski offered this wonderfully pithy formulation of what goes on in magical performance. Words which are meant for things that have no ears fall upon ears they are not meant for. His point was that magical incantations, although supposed to exert a direct effect on the things of nature to which they are addressed, and in the Trobriands it's often plants, you know, plant, grow, telling the plant to grow in some magical formula. The plant hasn't got any ears, it doesn't hear anything, but these words that are supposed to have a direct effect on the thing of nature actually work their effects on any human listeners who happen to be within earshot, and that it was in terms of these latter effects that the real power of magic has to be understood. But taking Malinowski's observation at face value, it would seem that the significant distinction is not between persons and non-human things, but rather between beings with ears and beings without. And one's reminded of the classical Roman author Varro, who distinguished among slaves, domestic animals, and inanimate instruments on the grounds that the first were vocal, the second semi-vocal, and the third mute. The animal kingdom is, of course, replete with species that employ vocal communication and whose sense of hearing is often highly developed, more developed than ours on some registers. And individuals of these species can and do respond in more or less intentional ways to human calls. If there's anything odd about the sort of performance designated as magical, it's just that action is presented in a sensory register alien to that of the being addressed in it. So, are we to conclude that social interactions are interactions among hearing beings? Well, such a restriction would be both arbitrary and absurd. It would, for example, exclude the deaf. And even for people with normal hearing, it would artificially isolate one modality, the vocal auditory, from all the other modalities of action which may just as well involve body posture, manual gesture, facial expression, touch, or all at once. There's no necessary reason, therefore, why the domain of the social should be open only to beings with ears, let alone to human beings in particular. On the contrary, since hearing, seeing, touch, posture, gesture, and so on are all forms of movement, the social should be open to all beings that move, and that, being endowed with perceptual systems, respond to each other's movements. Or in a word, it should be open to all animate beings. Or in short, to be social is to be alive, alive both in and to the surrounding environment. Different beings, of course, have different sensibilities and capabilities of action, and in our dealings with them, we ordinarily adopt those sensory registers that are appropriate in each case. But there's no register that escapes the domain of our sensory involvement in our environment, no discourse that doesn't subsist in the process of our bodily dwelling. So if some relations are social, then all are, and all life would be social life. So you might wonder, what need do we have of a concept of the social at all? Indeed, at one stage I thought we might as well dispense with it, that we don't need it, we'll just talk about life, full stop. But to answer this question, well, what need do we have of the social? We need to return to the second misconception that I identified in the formulation of the social brain hypothesis. You'll remember that the first is, just to recapitulate the argument, is that it sets up a false opposition between social and ecological relations. That is, in terms of the hypothesis, between relations between individuals of the same species and relations between individuals of different species. Even if we accept the idea that the brain is an internal information processor that manipulates and orchestrates the individual's conduct in the external domain of social interaction, we would still have to admit that the portfolio of any individual's relationships would include a great deal more than relationships with conspecifics. So what's the point of saying, you know, that humans can manage in groups of 150, given the fact that humans are managing with a whole lot of beings of all sorts beyond that, we'd never even begun to enumerate. And that at once invalidates Dunbar's idea of the group size bottleneck. However, it is precisely the assumption that the brain is an information processor that we now have to question. That's the second thing wrong with the social brain hypothesis. Adhering to what's commonly called the theory of mind approach, Dunbar assumes that the job of the mind brain is to construct internal representations of what are supposed to be or inferred to be the states of mind of others so that one can both predict their likely actions and calculate how best to act towards them. So it's assumed that every actor is acting on the basis of an internal state of mind. In order to work out how to act towards you, I've got to figure out what's in your mind, and so then I can figure out how best to respond to what you're going to say to me. And it goes backwards and forwards in this complicated thing. They even talk, you get these discussions about nth order, seventh, eighth, ninth order intentionality, in which I act in accordance with my construction of what you're thinking about, me thinking about you, thinking about me, thinking about you. And think, what world are these people living in? Anyway. But in this approach, there's a hard and fast boundary between mind and world, and that boundary surrounds the individual actor. So it's the temptation whenever you say, here is a person, here is an actor, here is an individual, what do? You draw a circle. Okay, there is a person, mind inside, maybe in a box, world outside. And there's this big, hard boundary because you can't know anything about what's out there unless you've reconstructed it in here. We're quite familiar with that picture. It's been very deep-seated in psychology. So the mind is, on the inside, processing information about the external world in which the mind's outputs are implemented and have effects. So rather ironically, Dunbar's social brain is unequivocally individual and not social. It might be social in its functions or in its effects, but it is individual in its constitution and its mode of existence. It is quite unequivocally in here, whereas the social stuff is going on out there. So that's to say, in its architecture and its properties, the so-called social brain is constituted independently and in advance of any relationships with others in which its owner might subsequently engage. Now, the deep-seated assumption that mind is an internal property of individuals that can be studied in isolation from their involvement with one another and with the wider environment continues to reverberate within the field of mainstream psychology. It has, however, been widely challenged, and ever more so. One of the first to issue such a challenge was the great pioneer of psychological anthropology, A. Irving Hallowell. In an extraordinarily prescient paper on, it was called The Self in Its Behavioral Environment, published back in 1954, Hallowell concluded that no physical barrier can come between mind and world. Any inner-outer dichotomy, he maintained, with the human skin as boundary, is psychologically irrelevant. 15 years later, Gregory Bateson made exactly the same point. Mind, Bateson insisted, is not confined within individual bodies as against a world out there, but is immanent in the entire system of organism-environment relations within which all human beings, creatures of all kinds, are necessarily enmeshed. The mental world, as he famously put it, is not limited by the skin. Rather, it reaches out into the environment along multiple and ever-extending sensory pathways of the organism's involvement in its surroundings. Or as Andy Clark has observed still more recently, the mind has a way of leaking from the body, mingling shamelessly with the world around it. The earth, the sky, the very ground we walk, and everything on and in it are all part of what Clark would call the mind's wideware. They're not just what we think and know about, but underwrite and form an essential part of our very capacity to know. So thinking is not the operation of a brain in a body, but the movement of a living, breathing being as it goes along in the world. So I invoke the word social, to get back to the question, what do we need the word social for? I invoke the word social to signify this understanding of the essential interpenetration or commingling of mind and world. So far from serving to demarcate a particular domain of phenomena, as opposed, say, to the biological or the psychological, I take the word social to denote a certain ontology, an understanding of the constitution of the phenomenal world itself. As such, it's opposed to an ontology of the particulate that imagines a world of individual entities, each of which is linked through external contact that leaves its basic nature unaffected. Or in the terms of the physicist David Bohm, the order of such an imagined world would be explicate. The order of the social world, by contrast, is implicate. That's to say, any particular phenomenon on which we might choose to focus our attention enfolds within its constitution the totality of relations of which, in their unfolding, it is the momentary outcome. So it enfolds and unfolds. And that's exactly, I suppose, how we should understand a brain, almost as a process of enfolding life into itself. And this brings me to the final misconception in Dunbar's social brain hypothesis. It treats the brain as a computational organ, a command and control center set off from the body that allegedly responds to its commands. So the typical picture is here's the brain, here's the body, here's the world. World sends signals to the body, body sends signals to the brain sends signals down to the body, body acts in the world. That's the standard command and control picture. And as you can recognize it immediately as a Cartesian construction in which it's simply been, so to speak, neurologized. But the brain, of course, is not an organ. It is, if you like, an entanglement of neural tissue, which is analogous, if anything, to something like a patch of tropical forest or grassy vegetation, just stuff growing in a rather luxuriant way all over the place. Here's Deleuze and Guattari in A Thousand Plateaus. I just want to quote. "Thought is not arborescent, and the brain is not a rooted or ramified matter. What are wrongly called dendrites don't assure the connection of neurons in a continuous fabric. The discontinuity between cells, the role of the axons, the functioning of the synapses, the existence of synaptic microfissures, the leap each message makes across these fissures, make the brain a multiplicity immersed in its plane of consistency or neuralgia, a whole uncertain probabilistic system." Many people have a tree growing in their heads. I'm not sure what he means by that, but he said, many people have a tree growing in their heads, but the brain itself is much more a grass than a tree. And then he has a quote from Stephen Rose, who's here. "The axon and the dendrite twist around each other like bindweed around brambles, with synapses at each of the thorns." So let's then not ask what the brain does, but what is going on there. The brain is not an agent, but a hive of activity. Looks to me a bit more like a compost heap than a sort of computer, at least not a functioning computer. And the patterns of activity of neural of tissue then are inseparable from those conducted throughout the body. And these patterns spill out in the world along lines of movement and growth. In some way, you could say that a braining is a knotting together of these lines. One way of drawing it and comparing it to this sort of picture would be to say, well, you've got one line going like this, and another one going like this, and another one going like this, and none of these lines have actual ends, another one like that. And sort of in there is the brain. But it's not a rigidly demarcated box. It has no boundaries about it. Its lines trail off in all sorts of directions to the skin and beyond in endless pathways. Perhaps another analogy might be just to take a fabric and imagine that you knot it up or scrumple it up somewhere, and then all sorts of surfaces of the fabric come into contact that would not otherwise, and transactions can take place across them. Perhaps the brain is something like that. But the crucial thing is that just as with the fabric, it's all one fabric. It's not as though the brain is another bit that is locked on to the body. It's all part of the same fabric. So the brain itself is part of the same fabric as the body, which is the same part of the same fabric as the world. And this actually makes a nonsense of the notion of group size. Just to go back to Dunbar and the social brain hypothesis, remember he says, what is the maximum size of social groups that brains can handle? In order to produce a countable world, you have to cut it up into bits to atomize it and say, how many individuals do we have here? And the sort of folded fabric that gives us the brain does not form part, I think, of a countable world. Well, the previous speaker quoted the words of Emily Dickinson, which I had not heard before and I was delighted by, and I'm going to read them again because I like it so much and because actually they almost coincide with the quotation that I was going to read. So I'll put them two side by side. I wrote this down very quickly. I hope I got it right. This is Emily Dickinson. "The brain is wider than the sky, for put them side by side, the one the other will include with ease and you beside." Here are the words of St. Augustine in his Confessions. "Inside me, in the vast cloisters of my memory, are the sky, the earth, and the sea, ready at my summons, together with everything I have perceived in them by my senses." And I want to, I think, by this, using the words of both Emily Dickinson and St. Augustine, to protest against the ways of theorizing the embodiment of knowledge that proceed as though earth and sky, indeed the world itself, were extrinsic to what mindful bodies are. I want to protest against psychologistic approaches to what is sometimes called grounded cognition that effectively put the ground inside the brain, leaving individuals stranded in an unspecified environment which is invoked merely for the purposes of allowing the body to have something material to interact with. The increasing regard for neurological correlates of knowing, I think, has been matched by an increasing disregard for the marvellous complexities of the world we inhabit, indeed, for life itself. And we need to reverse this. Of course, the brain is embodied, but it's only embodied because the body itself is enworlded. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. You finished 2 minutes ahead of schedule, so we have lots of time.
Everybody to...
Hi, Micah Allen again from Aarhus University. Really a beautiful talk. I really enjoyed it. And they say the friend of, or the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So I don't know if you'll like this empirical data, but I think I can give you a little bit of empirical ammunition. Dunbar has made much ado about this notion that there's significantly more prefrontal gray matter in human beings compared to non-human chimps and things. But a recent meta-analysis of structural brain scans actually showed that the prefrontal gray matter was not significantly different from what you would expect based on body size increase alone. What was different was the prefrontal white matter. And this is significant because neurobiological studies show that white matter has much higher degree of plasticity than gray matter. There's something like a 7% turnover in the synapses per week in certain areas of the brain. And I think this fits nicely with your picture to bring this into back into Dunbar. He's recently come into my area, which is the research of internet and social media technologies, saying that, you know, the use of Facebook and social media technologies is exploding our brain's ability to deal with, you know, we're going way past our 150 number, which to me is just ridiculous because I don't feel overwhelmed by my ability to use social media technologies at all. So I guess that would just be mostly a comment that maybe there's even some empirical weakness to his theory, and that maybe a better picture is like this squiggly line one you have here, because a more plastic brain is more able to specialize and use tools and do the kinds of things that Andy Clark tends to talk about with integrating tool use into our mental fabric. So,
well, thank you very much.
Awesome talk.
I mean, it also helps. That helps me with a thing that's always nagging at the back of my mind, which is that, and I know which Robin would say to me if I argued against him. He said, "Look, hell, you see a room full of human beings as we see here, and they've all got bloody big brains, and they're using up all this energy. And have you come up?" He would say to me, "Have you come up with any kind of explanation of why that should be so?" And I said, "Not my business. I don't like your terms. You know, it's a slight problem that I'm not sure how to deal with it."
It seems very uneconomical that I should be representing everyone's representations of the world at the same time to make some statement.
Absolutely, yeah.
Thanks for the quote, Tim, and a lovely talk. Actually, I decided that I preferred your compost heap to the bindweed around the axles. Maybe we'll go that direction in future. I wanted to come back briefly to Dunbar, whose latest book I reviewed last week, in which Dunbar's number appears to be, depending on how you read it, 3, 7, 150, or 1,500.
Oh.
And like you... As I commented in the review, I'm not sure what Facebook and Twitter are actually going to do with the number of people who claim to want to be my friend as a result of, who I've never heard of at all. But I wanted to come back to Emily Dickinson, and I want to have a note of caution about it, because by one's metaphors, you should know people. And I'm impressed by the number of highly reductionist neuroscientists who love Emily Dickinson and quote her at the beginning of their books. In particular, I have in mind here Jerry Edelman, writing extensively about consciousness and what he calls neural Darwinism, and Dickinson features there. And the reason why she features there is because they make precisely the relationship of the convergence of mind to brain.
Ooh.
So when Dickinson says brain, they read it as saying mind is brain. I would say, and I guess you would say, the mind is wider than the brain. So let's stay with St. Augustine, I think.
Okay, yeah. I didn't know. I come as a completely naive person so far as Emily Dickinson is concerned. But I see your point. You can... I liked Augustine's point. It's pretty cool.
I'm Therese Schilhup, Gnosis. I want to thank you for a wonderful talk. And then I don't want to be devil's advocate, because actually I really like to talk. On the other hand, I am a biologist. And when you talk about everybody being social, all animals being social, then, of course, I was brought up in a tradition in which we were told that primates are more social animals than anyone else. So I would like to ask you, don't you see that there's any, in your opinion, isn't there any difference between the social behaviors of, for instance, primates or humans and ants? Now, of course, ants, the ant example is a very bad example, but then the spider, for instance.
Yeah, well, I think the answer to that is that clearly there are a whole lot of different kinds of animals, and they all behave in different ways, and often even within the same species we get lots and lots of different behaviors. And we can describe those differences, and that's all fine, and I have no problem with it. I begin to have a problem when suddenly there are two buckets, and into one bucket goes social, and into another bucket goes non-social. Anthropologists have a bit the same problem with culture. You know, what, we put something in one bucket or the other, and then once you start doing that, then you get into the problem. People start asking, is this animal more or less social than the other one? And as soon as you start asking questions like that, then you must have some standard, some measuring rod, by which you calibrate sociality across species. And then you're no longer into simply describing the way in which this or that animal goes about their business. We are involved in a comparative exercise in which there are two poles of highly social and not social at all, and reptiles down at the bottom and primates and humans up at the top. So in that sense, in the sense in which social is most commonly used in biology and studies of animal behavior, I think it's actually rather unhelpful, and I would rather simply remove it and simply talk about what animals do without the baggage that comes with the concept of society. But then I thought, for the purposes of this argument, well, maybe there is another sense in which we could retain the social, but in a very, very different sort of meaning, maybe more Latourian. I don't know, this sort of one. Imagine not bound in any sense by what kind of thing you're talking about, but more to do with just saying something about the way the world is, which is that it is through and through relational.
So maybe you wouldn't like to adopt the, if you're looking for quotes, Margaret Thatcher would be, of course, an option. There is no society, but I guess you don't want that.
No.
Thank you very much for a marvelous talk. I agree with you that, of course, it's a regrettable fact that now, at this point, neuroscience is so fashionable, and on the other hand, questions of surrounding social interaction become less funded, and many people believe, and politicians, especially in this country, as I heard yesterday evening, seem to believe that if they put a lot of money into neuroscience, all the other questions might be solved, and it's certainly important to say, no, it's incorrect, and that is certainly not the case. It's certainly important to look at social sciences, and I admire your work in this area. However, I should say that with regard to your critique of Dunbar, you made a few claims which I cannot fully share with you, because, or I think, to put it very strongly, I would say they are false even. I hate to say that, I should say. One of them is, of course, to say, well, the relationship of an individual doesn't just isn't exhausted by the relationships to other individuals of the same species, but they are relationships to plants, to animals, from a human being. This is all good and fine. However, the intensity of the interaction and the time spent per day is maybe different. And if you look at certain monkeys that groom each other all day, almost all day, then this is a different kind of interaction compared with me watering the flowers because I have been told to. And your second point, that there's no sharp boundary around certain entities such as the brain, I think you do not mean this serious. There's obviously a boundary around, or the brain ends somewhere, and maybe the nerves go out to the end of the body somewhere, but then there is a limit to that. Of course, our input is not limited to what touches our skin, but we receive signals from as far as we can see. Not so far if you're short-sighted. So there are these kind of boundaries. Even though we are you may be right in saying it's the same fabric, the brain, the body, and the world. There are clearly different things, and I think a bridge between the world and the brain is the action of the brain, or actually not the brain, of the person, and which actually has a component of activation in the brain and body movement, and of course a clear effect in the environment and in society. So there, with regard to actions, these are entities that are perfect examples of your case crossing these boundaries, which, however, I should insist, exist. And with regard to Dunbar, why not even look into the brain and say, even within that brain, there might be boundaries too? Namely, there might be neuronal assemblies that actually distinguish between entities, between the flower and the human, and between humans of different kinds. And maybe that's the key to our brain evolution, namely that we as humans got more and more able to build up more and more such, if you wish, representations, such neuronal ensembles that actually allowed us to distinguish more and more entities in the environment. But this is a different kind of separation within the brain and outside. Sorry for the long comment.
No, that's really helpful, and thanks for the comment, and I'll try to respond. On the first one, your point is, which is well taken, is that surely if you look at the full range of an individual's interactions, some are very intensive and some are not. And that may be true, but it's not necessarily the case that the intensive ones are with the conspecifics. I mean, you gave an example of primates, chimpanzees, whatever, might be spending many hours a day grooming each other, as indeed they do, perhaps not much time getting food compared with the amount of time they spend grooming. But on the other hand, I could think of ethnographic examples of people, particularly during certain seasons of the year, when they might actually have very few other humans about and spend very little time with them, but be out almost all the time hunting or fishing, so that, you know, it can work both ways. You might have more intensive interactions with conspecifics, but you might not. And a theory which works on the assumption that the intense interactions are always going to be with conspecifics can't apply.
Okay. If you allow me, I have a direct comment to that too. Of course, you're speaking about humans which are evolved, which now have this huge brain.
Right.
And if it's not just good for heating the body, the brain, then it might be good for other things, namely, and it's obviously very good at building up representations. So if you are now burdened with this brain that constantly builds representations which had been evolved to interact successively in a larger society, then it may well, then this
that might
perfectly accounts for the fact that in this specific situation, where suddenly society is missing the single person,
but if you go,
a small group would start to interact and take the tree and the flower and the and the deer.
Okay, but if you go to the non-human world, think of all the cases of close symbiosis, cross-specific symbiosis, where it would be pretty hard to say that you could find a more intensive relationship. Actually, I should think that it would be quite easy to find cases in the non-human animal kingdom of symbiosis where the intensity and time and space intensity of interaction with the symbiont is considerably greater than anything with fellow members of the same species. But just can I just get back to the thing about boundaries, because this is rather crucial. I think to answer it, we've got to be more precise than I was about different kinds of possible boundaries there might be. I mean, obviously, for example, within the brain, there are synaptic boundaries and thresholds and membranes and all sorts of things across which currents are passing. So they're all if you're thinking of the brain, well, I'm looking at the brain, then all sorts of stuff inside the brain wouldn't appear like boundaries. But if you took a finer grain, you might think of that as a boundary. Of course, in a sense, the brain ends somewhere, but an ending is not necessarily a boundary in the sense that I was meaning it. And I think that I was giving this boundary a kind of ontological weight somebody like Bateson would say, of course, the skin is a boundary, but stuff goes across it. And it's just one of a whole lot of boundaries. This classic example of a blind man walking down the street with a cane. You could say, well, there's the tip of the cane, there's the place where the cane meets your hand, there's the skin, there are the boundaries inside the body of the brain. There are a whole series of boundaries, but the actual process, the flow, is going across all of those. But I think a lot of the neuroscience discourse, and specifically the thought that Dunbar is invoking there, is much more Cartesian. Descartes obviously had this idea of the brain tickling the mind. There's some mysterious transfer going on from the body brain to the mental apparatus. And that was it's always been mysterious because it involves shifting over an ontological boundary. And I think that there's a certain kind of neuroscience discourse that is still invoking that kind of boundary.
Okay, we have two more very brief questions.
Yep, Sten Neverlarsen, Gnosis. We might say that we live in a time where we have a neurocentric biologization of the social going on. So, and we can criticize and have reservations towards us, as you have, as and I have. But can we also go the reverse way and talk about a socialization of the human biology, and therefore dare to say that human communication, language, exchange, and have actually all of them formed the biology, even changed the brain? So in order to get back about the land card of politics of science, we could say as sociologists or anthropologists or cultural theoretical guys that we can tell something about how the brain was formed and then go against this very heavy drive motive way highway of the first way of arguing, which is the neurocentric reductive biologization of the social.
Absolutely. I think that's the way we need to go. It's taken quite a big... anthropologists have had to swallow very hard recently because we've always worked with the idea that we're not interested in biological differences as such, we're interested in cultural differences, and so far as culture is concerned, biological differences such as they are make no difference. That we can treat everybody alike biologically and then look at the cultural differences. And we've had to recognize that... That when people differ in their skills, for example, in the ways they walk or in musical instruments they play or whatever kinds of skills they have, those differences affect the way their brains develop. And because the brain is so plastic, if you were able to look inside it, you would find neurological correlates of cultural difference. And that's been a big step for anthropology to take. But it's, I think, more or less... Well, plenty of us are taking it. And then the next step on from that is suddenly to realize that if we're interested in cultural what we always call cultural differences, then neurological considerations have got to be absolutely central to the account. It poses an enormous problem for us because it's so the literature is so technical, so difficult. It's very difficult for us to be able to say anything with any authority on the subject of the brain. But we've come that far as to realise that we've got to have an integrated account, and that's been a big shift.
Okay, last question before lunch.
Thank you for an inspiring talk. There's a lot of philosophers who would support what you've said. To mention a few, Gabriel Marcel, Merleau-Ponty, Boss and Binswanger, who are based on Heidegger. Boss, he said regarding the border of the body, if there is one, that he said there isn't any. He said, when I'm looking at a star, I'm stretched out towards the star. And then I'm a physiotherapist. We work in neurorehabilitation a lot, and neuroscience need to provide tools for us, research tools for going outside in. And of course, we also need the inside out, as Pulvermüller talked about yesterday. So I'm very happy to hear you talking like this. And all the science need to do practical things that we can apply it outside in.
Yeah, okay. I'm quite happy to agree with your comment.
Good. Well, then we can thank our speaker. And, and we'll start again in just under an hour, let's say 10 minutes to 1. And we'll go now together over to the aula where we've had lunch the past 2 days as well.